I want to go through three different examples of how what I talked about the other day applies to specific biblical characters. The first example will be Queen Esther from the book of Esther. That's the continuation of the study group we had before. And the other two are both about Abraham. And that's really, as you all realize by now, Esther is the name of a late biblical book. And there are two female figures who play a prominent role in the book. One of them is Vashti, who is the quote-unquote queen of Ahasuerus. And the other is Esther, who in the course of events replaces her. The biblical text itself, in describing Esther, dwells on her beauty. It describes her as having been taken to the king's harem, basically. Many moderns talk in terms of Esther having won a Miss Persia contest. This is a totally erroneous concept. It's a wonderful example of projecting the 20th century onto ancient times. There was no beauty contest. The king assembled, or the king's servants assembled for him a large collection of virgins. He tried them out one at a time. Each of them became his property. Okay, it's not like the winner won and became the queen and the rest went home and were free to compete in the next contest. Once the king had sex with them, they were his. They were part of the harem. And as you see later in the story, if you got close to one of them, you could be executed for it. So, you know, this whole idea of Queen Esther winning a beauty contest is really quite erroneous. No more different, really, than the story, the coloring books I was telling Steve about the other day, where you have Hasidic communities who have coloring books of biblical scenes, and all of the biblical characters are dressed like Hasidim. It's that same kind of anachronistic superimposition of later material on earlier material. In any case, from the book of Esther, there emerged some very serious questions about Esther's character and religiosity. And this is what I want to discuss with you for the first few minutes of the presentation. The book of Esther never mentions God. The book of Esther seems to be a highly secular presentation of events. There are allusions to God, but no direct references. And we'll get to Esther's behavior in a minute. But this question of how Esther conducted herself throughout the story has been a major issue in Jewish literature for over 2,000 years. And I want to just highlight some examples of this for a couple of minutes to show you the give and take on the subject. First of all, in the two texts that I distributed, which we started to read before but didn't get too far in, what you have is two ancient Greek versions of the Bible and you compare it to the Hebrew text. If you look carefully at what's called the A text, which is, for those of you who know the book of Esther, the one that is least like what you're used to seeing, you'll see that relative to the other text, which is actually the Hebrew plus some Greek additions, which you will find in the Septuagint and now in many Christian Bibles, the difference in the presentation of Esther in these two books is striking. All right, there's far less information about Esther in the A text. In other words, without going through the whole history of these things, in biblical times, or in very, very shortly thereafter, somebody wrote, or edited, as it were, for consumption in Greek, a version of the story that seems to have downplayed the role of Esther in this whole event. Now, whether that's because of any of the issues I just raised, I have no way of knowing. But the image of Esther that emerges if you read the A text relative to the Hebrew or the Greek, that would be standard Hebrew and standard Greek, you'll see that there, the character is somewhat different. Some of these things have been, some of the problems have been eliminated, but I can't tell you what the motivation was. Similarly, if you look at Josephus, first century Hellenistic Jewish historian, when he tells the story, he also redesigns the character of Esther and also many of the other people for consumption in the Roman world. In other words, you see that there is a certain need in some contexts to alter the image of Esther as she appears. Perhaps the clearest example of this is in the additions to Esther that you find in the Greek text, the Septuagint, compared to the Hebrew. There are six supplementary paragraphs, and as somebody pointed out already this morning, just from a cursory look at them, these extra paragraphs contain many, many references to God. They contain several prayers. They contain a dream, which is understood to be a form of divine revelation. And so in Greek, the book of Esther is a very pious composition, whereas in Hebrew, it is a very secular-looking composition. So secular that Yitz Greenberg, a contemporary Orthodox rabbi in New York, has suggested the real lesson to learn from the book of Esther is that secular Jews have a contribution to make to the well-being of their people. Okay, that's how far it goes. I'm not adopting that position, but I think it's an interesting argument. It shows you how far you can go in reading the text this way. When the rabbis of the Talmudic Midrashic era took a look at Esther, they were confronted by the same issue. Now, to highlight this problem in language that will become apparent later, Esther lived after Sinai. That's the issue here. Abraham lived before Sinai. Okay, so there's a totally different question that will come to later about the religiosity of Abraham. Whether Abraham follows Mosaic law, we'll get to. But Esther, who lives after the time of Moses, presumably should be conducting herself according to Mosaic law. And if you read the book of Daniel, which is set in more or less the same time and place, you see, for example, right up front in the beginning of the book, that Daniel and his friends refuse to eat the king's food. So, you know, to use contemporary language, they keep kosher. And there are other examples. He almost gets killed for praying. All right, all of these kinds of things show you that within that time and space, there were books written with a strong religious thrust. Other people have compared Esther to the book of Judith, which you find in the Apocrypha, where again you have a much more pious image of this woman. And there are other examples as well. So Esther does stand out to some extent. These changes in the Greek text alter her model. The rabbis had the Hebrew text. They couldn't alter it. That was no longer considered to be part of the way you deal with it, but they did have the opportunity to do two things. They could interpret what it says, and they could, through their midrashic additions, in a sense, reshape the text or reshape the character. So I'd like to give you some examples of ways in which they looked at the book and were able to support the image of Esther's religiosity from it. First of all, it says in several places that Esther had servants. So rabbis constructed the theory that she had a different servant serve her each day of the week. And that way she was able to have one special servant for Shabbat. And she conducted herself differently on Shabbat, but nobody else knew except that one servant. And by doing this, she was able to be a Sabbath observer while she was married to the king. Another theory that was presented in one of the Midrashim, based on what has been claimed to be a Persian belief, although I don't know that for a fact, there is a belief that everybody has a spiritual double. So that when Esther was in bed with the king, she wasn't really there, it was only this spiritual double that was there. So Esther was never guilty of any illicit sexual relationship with the king. That's not in the biblical text, it's a midrash. And similarly, there are attempts made to show that Esther was able, given the statements in different places, to follow other kinds of observances. One of the most interesting passages, which is in the Talmud, is one that says that Mordechai, who is described in the Bible as being Esther's cousin, not her uncle. Okay, a lot of people think uncle, but that's wrong. Text says cousin. Josephus and Jerome say uncle, but I don't know why. Maybe because of the whole problem of the relationship. But anyway, I mean, here's this man living with his very attractive female relative. It would be more appropriate, since they were marriageable, that they be married. And the rabbis, in fact, consummated this marriage. They said that when it says in the book that Mordechai adopted Esther, lakach lo levat, took her as a daughter, that that really means he married her, took her, as it were, levayit, bayit, which in some context means house, also can mean a wife. And so they said that when it says bat, it really means bayit, and he married her. Now, the reason given in the literature for this is the use of the word bat in a parable with Nathan and David, where he tells a story about this man who had a sheep, and the sheep used to lie in his lap or bosom like a daughter. And the Talmud says, wait a minute, that's not how you treat a daughter. Now, I always imagined it was a baby daughter. But anyway, that's not how you treat a daughter. That's how you treat a wife. So it, that over the word bat over there, daughter, must mean wife. And over here, it can mean the same thing. This is good midrashic method. Only I honestly believe that the texts have left out one important piece of glue that makes this more reasonable. In ancient times, among the many variations in Hebrew and Aramaic pronunciation, this one actually still exists, that existed, was the fact that the sound of the letter Y, Yud, was often clipped. Okay, so for example, in the Mishnah, you have the word Chav. It should be Chayav. Talmud says, why does it say Chav? Babylonian Talmud says, why does it say Chav, not Chayav? Because the person speaking was a Palestinian. Palestinians talk that way. Okay? I believe, I could give you a lot more examples of this, okay? I don't see why I should bother. But there are many, many examples where the letter Yud is clipped. The name of the Prime Minister, Rabin, of Israel, what was his first name? Yitzchak. They say Yitzchak, not Yitzchak. Okay? I'm referring to the first letter of Yitzchak. They don't always say it all the time. That's why Yitzchak is a nickname for Yitzchak. That's why in Arabic, Yisrael begins with an olive. That's why in Syriac, the word for hand begins with an olive. Okay? There are many, many, many examples of this phenomenon. All right? And I think what happened is here that in ancient times, the word bayit and the word bat sounded much more alike than we pronounce them today. And that helped make this association stick. In any case, whether I'm right or wrong about that analysis, according to these texts, Mordechai married Esther. And this now raises a totally different issue. It says in the book, that in the biblical book, that when Esther was taken to the king, it says she was taken. So those people who are concerned about what happened to her say she was forced. And any sexual activity in which she engaged, she was basically raped. And therefore, one has to look at her with great sympathy, but that one does not hold her responsible for any of the things that happened. However, if she was married to Mordechai, it raises the stakes tremendously, because now she's a married woman. And while married women who are raped are no more guilty than unmarried women who are raped, there comes a point in the story when Mordechai sends Esther to the king. According to the story, as the rabbis understood it, Esther didn't just go visit the king. She had to go seduce him. This now becomes willful intercourse, not rape. And if she's married to Mordechai, a whole series of issues of law and propriety unfold that are much more severe than if she's not married. And so you find within rabbinic literature extensive discussions of this particular problem. Okay, now, in his commentary on the book of Esther, Rashi identifies this particular position as midrashic, which is the way the Talmud presents it. In his commentary on the Talmud, however, he doesn't say it's midrashic, he just explains the story. So those people who look at Rashi's Bible commentary at least have an inkling of what's happening here. But many of the ones who read his Talmud commentary and followed it seem to be of the mind that this actually took place. So if you look, for example, at Ibn Ezra, these are medieval commentaries, right? He says point blank, this didn't happen, this is not part of the story, don't worry about it. As he would say about many other midrashim of this sort. but others follow it. And so if they got married, there's a whole discussion in rabbinic literature as to why he didn't divorce her before she was taken to the palace. This is not in the biblical text at all, neither the marriage nor the divorce. And for 600 or 800 years, we have discussions of what happens to this divorce, until finally, Yechezkel Landau, 18th century, I think, said it is definitive. He divorced her. End of discussion. Okay? So it took all those centuries to figure this out, but that was the only way out of the problem, right? He simply could not have allowed this to happen, that she, as a married woman, would be doing this. Yehuda. There's another dimension to the discussion as well that perhaps has more practical implications. In the 15th and 16th centuries, there are various rabbinic responsa that deal with a related problem. The story is told in one of them of a family traveling through the forest of Europe. Forests in Europe were fairly serious places to be, and there were highwaymen. And this one particular group was captured by highwaymen, and in order to secure safe passage for herself and her husband, the very attractive wife of one of the men traveling in the carriage prostituted herself to the leader of the highwaymen. Okay? So she is now, in a legal sense, guilty of violating her marriage. A woman who willfully does so is considered to be guilty of a very serious crime. And all else aside, the husband is expected to divorce her. The question arose whether the woman should be considered to be innocent of all wrongdoing on the model of Esther. And there are other discussions around similar things. Indeed, some of these discussions pull Sarah into the picture, because Sarah too was sent or allowed by her husband into a foreigner's bed. Okay, and so the debate that emerges on the assumption of the marriage, right, no divorce, takes a very, very different look at Esther from what you find in most of the popular literature on the subject. And interestingly enough, there are actually two rabbinic opinions on the subject. Some people say that Esther is indeed a model of this kind of behavior, and therefore the woman should not be held responsible. But others say that it's not the same thing. Esther did what she did through Mordecai's direction. Mordecai was in some sense a prophet. This was biblical times. Esther was saving the entire nation, not just one person. And they try to rationalize the behavior in some way that would in fact differentiate between what Esther did and what this 16th century woman did. Again, it's not my purpose here to discuss the ethics of the sexual situation, but rather to show you how the image of Esther has modulated in different contexts over the years. Another example of a medieval position on Esther is exemplified by the Maranos. In 1492, the Jews were expelled from Spain, but many of them remained in Spain. Most of the ones who remained converted outwardly to Christianity. The question was whether they converted inwardly. And there's a great amount of literature written on this. I don't want to go into it now. Interestingly enough, Esther became a heroine for the Maranos because they saw in her an example of someone who had lived outwardly as the queen of Persia and inwardly as a pious Jewess. So even as some Jews were busy debating whether the propriety of some of Esther's behavior, there were others who saw her as the paragon of virtue, in fact, the model for their own Jewish culture living in a coercive Christian environment.